So we're back in paper 15, section 6, and remember we got a little ways in last week. We're ready to start the 6th paragraph, the Dark Islands of Space paragraph, which is on the top of the old single column, page 173. Before we do, just to remind you of a sentence we read at the end of the previous paragraph, to undertake to describe all the various techniques involved in stellar metamorphosis and planetary evolution would require a narration of almost 100 different modes of sun formation and planetary origin. Remember, they had that little footnote after they went through the top 10, literally, list there. Since Jeanette mentioned it last week, I thought I'd just print out an example of et cetera, et cetera, that they're referring to at the end there. This is what's called Hoag's object, very unglamorous name, but initially it was just an object because they didn't know exactly what they were looking at, you know, in a dim little fuzzy view of it. But it's what's typically called a ring galaxy. You can see you don't have, you know, the typical sort of spiral arms or a bar coming off the central bulge. You just have this very curious object that looks a lot more like something that stuff was flung out in just general centrifugal fashion in every direction. And I'll hand it around because it's a pretty fun object to look at. If you look in the gap between that isolated central bulge and the ring of stars, you'll see off in the distance another tiny little ring galaxy that's actually behind it, coincidentally, which is pretty funny. And the other thing, another reason why I wanted to print this out is to get you familiar with how you can just tell immediately visually relatively where this galaxy is that you're looking at in a picture like this. Is it something that's in close, you know, like especially in the first outer space level? If it is, it's very likely there's going to be a bunch of foreground stars, you know, overlaying, because you're looking at a fairly close object, and so you have a fairly large field of view, and there's a bunch of stars in the Milky Way that, you know, are in the field of view in order to take an image of this not that distant galaxy. But you start, you know, taking a picture of a galaxy that's farther and farther out in the second outer space level, and you're zooming in on a narrower and narrower little angular region of direction that you're taking this photograph, you know, where most likely you'll be looking in between the stars in the foreground, and there won't really be that many foreground stars, you know, in the field of view. It'll be a lot blacker, background. And so you can see that with this image, because this is an object that's way out there in the outer, you know, getting into the outer regions of the second outer space level. And you can see a handful of still even further galaxies, you know, way in the background. You know, you can see these thin little lens, you know, dots, lens-shaped dots, you know, that are a little spiral galaxy that are off even far, you know, even deeper in the remote reaches of the second outer space level, where, like we've pointed out to about 300,000 light years, you've got quite a bit of galaxy building that the force organizers have done for eons. Those galaxies, you have kind of this sort of primary build radius, you know, out to 300 million light years, and all those galaxies within that radius, have been around, or most of them have been around for quite a long time, you know, and so they've started to clump together and whatnot because of gravity, and they're interacting and things. Out in the outer, like half, sort of the second outer space level, it's much more uniform, and you have just these very embryonic galaxies that they're, you know, whirling up, you know, sort of uniformly scattered all the way around you. Okay, and so when So you're looking at some of those embryonic galaxies way out there, you know, in sort of that outer half of the second outer space level, you know, including that one little ring one that you can, you know, see behind the big ring here. And just a little personal note about, you know, it's called Hoag's object. It's named after the astronomer that discovered it, Art Hoag, who I got a chance to meet one time. He was director of the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, for a number of years. And one time when I was visiting my aunt and uncle there in Flagstaff, my aunt, you know, knew him and called him up, and Art gave me a personal tour around the Lowell Observatory back in the, you know, back in the areas that only the scientists get to go and stuff, because I was working on my PhD, you know, and so I was an insider. So that was kind of fun. So I actually got to meet Art, and you know, and he gave me that little personal tour. So you know, that is another reason I thought it'd be fun to just show that.
How far out is the second outer space level?
So you've got, well, the revelators tell us point blank the actual distances involved. You have 50 million light years of the first outer space level. And then you have 50 million light years of gap between the two levels. And then the second outer space level, you know, which is something like, you know, 500 million light years thick in radius. And this object, when you start getting out there, the farther you get out there, the more there's going to be significant error in the distances that they think these objects are away, because a lot of their redshift is not due to just the simple Doppler redshift of the respiration of the galaxies. It's due to the active presence of the force organizers that are, you know, present. You know, or even that object, you know, when you're looking at it, there's associate transcendental master force organizers present in that picture too, besides that matter. They're tending every galaxy out there. And, you know, the more embryonic the galaxy, the more very active their presence is, and the more they're affecting the photons that are leaving. So you get these objects that seem to have these really, really high redshifts. So the astronomers think they're very, 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 very far away. You know, what would have to be third outer space level, but they're not. They're in that outer half of the second, and there's a lot of non-respiration redshift, you know, in their spectrum.
Yeah. What are they standing on?
Yeah. They don't have to stand on anything, because they're transcendent beings. They're standing in some absonite sense, see, not in a finite sense, and projecting their presence down into the finite. You know, it's a question that is imponderable.
But I thought you said all beings, for instance, stand on the aisle. Is that in an absonite sense also?
Well, I mean, sure, you can have transcendentalists standing on the aisle because, you know, even though they're an absonite being, the aisle is absolute.
Yeah.
But somewhere out in finite space and time, okay, all right, they're not standing on anything. Right, they have, yeah, see, we just don't understand exactly how that works. What they're, I mean, how does this really work for beings who literally have a direct relationship, a conscious relationship with transcendental space and time? I mean, do they see the whole, you know, a post-finite universe, and they're actually standing in it? And, I mean, we don't, you know, we don't understand how this works. Yep.
How many Master Force organizers are there? Is that mentioned at all?
Countless, apparently. I mean, think about it. You've got hundreds of millions of galaxies, and you know, and you know, so yeah, there's just some huge number of them. Yeah, you know, that, remember, they, the revelators are not allowed to tell us very much about them. There's a lot of very strong revelatory mandate in, you know, in play about transcendental beings.
That shows literally thousands of these tiny little galaxies all over. That's a big one. We really should have brought it in.
You know, I mean, there may be, you know, 200 million embryonic galaxies out in the outer reaches of second outer space lover or something, you know? I mean, there's going to be a lot of them. But you don't have billions and billions and billions like they think, because it isn't, they aren't that far away, and they aren't, you don't have to fill that big a volume, you know, like the third outer space level. But still, hundreds of, and hundreds of millions is a big number.
Will each of the outer space regions increase by a factor of 10?
I don't know. I mean, there seems to be, you know, a quasi-pattern, right, in what they tell us about the super universe, first outer space, second outer space, but, yeah.
7, then 70, then 700.
Who knows? Yeah, but it definitely seems like it's something on the order of 50s turning into a, something like a 500 when you go to the second. You know, again, they don't tell you exactly how thick the second is. That's just kind of a speculation on my part that you have sort of a density increase out to that build radius, as I call it, of 300 million light years. He said that's about in the middle. And, you know, that's the way those levels work. You know, the density increases in the middle and then decreases back out to the outer margin. So, you know, I'm thinking it's something like 250, 250, see? But you know, you're just speculating. They don't give you, again, they weren't allowed to give us those details, apparently.
If we had flipped over the boundary and we're on our way back in, respiration-wise, would their influence still redshift, even to offset,
right,
the blue shift that you
that
have?
Would be, yeah, my, yeah.
That's an interesting,
I would think that they're actively, you know, redshifting by their presence, and that doesn't change with the respiration. Okay. So anyway, you know, as this is a simple example, there are all kinds of very odd objects, and, you know, current scientists really don't know what to make of that object, exactly how it formed. But like the revelators are saying, I mean, it's very complicated. You know, there's all kinds of three sigma, you know, variations on the theme, you know, in a distribution of ways of doing things, or ways things evolve. So, all right, so remember the last thing that we did there in section 6 was we talked about the number of glasses of water in the ocean analogy. All right, so let's start up with the dark islands of space here.
The dark islands of space. These are the dead suns and other large aggregations of matter devoid of light and heat. The dark islands are sometimes enormous in mass and exert a powerful influence in universe equilibrium and energy manipulation. The density of some of these large masses is well nigh unbelievable, and this great concentration of mass enables these dark islands to function as powerful balance wheels, holding large neighboring systems in effective leash. They hold the gravity balance of power in many constellations. Many physical systems, which would otherwise speedily dive to destruction in nearby suns, are held securely in the gravity grasp of these guardian dark islands. It is because of this function that we can locate them accurately. We have measured the gravity pull of the luminous bodies, and we can therefore calculate the exact size and location of the dark islands of space, which so effectively function to hold a given system steady in its course.
Okay, a number of little things I want to bring out with this. First of all, just a little loose end. Remember in the previous section, I mentioned that they had sort of a strange little passing sentence, a little comment. Some of the dense dark islands are the direct result of the accretions of transmuting energy in space. Okay? And, you know, saying energy rather than what the main thing they were talking about there was accreting actual cold mass, you know, matter. And when you, the reason that's kind of suspicious is what we just were reminded of here. How important these objects are for the master physical controllers and the power centers in regulating and stabilizing the whole vast super universe system and all of its hierarchical components, okay? You know, my suspicion is that they're, you know, because these objects are so critical, they're probably occasionally helping things a little bit, catalyzing the process a little bit. They may not necessarily, you know, build the whole thing, but they probably foster this in some ways that they're sort of alluding to as a subtext of that sentence back there, just because they're indispensable to the regulating this massive system of 10 trillion stars. Okay. Right, yeah, all the right. See, all those little details makes it suspicious that there's, yeah. Okay, now, a number of things. First of all, okay, the relators very purposely chose the language to describe what they're talking about here. They called them islands. Lands, islands, okay. There is landedness to them. There, you can stand on these things if you have the fortitude, you know. Okay. We're not talking about black holes. We're not talking about a hole. We're talking about land. Okay. The only difference is instead of being land in a vast ocean, you know, it's land in a vast spread of space.
And they don't call them dark spheres.
And they don't call them, well, but they're going to be spheres. Yeah. I mean, especially, you know, think about if it's a little burnt out star. It's spherical. I mean, it's very much being collected gravitationally, mm-hmm. even if they're facilitating it. Gravity works spherically. Yeah, everything's a sphere except the Isle of Paradise. That's different. You know, that's a fiat construct. That's not a gravity construct. Okay? Especially with this intense amount of gravity, it's going to be pretty spherical. that gravity is going to want to, you know, no matter how rigid this thing is, it's going to be pulling it into a pretty perfect sphere. Okay? All right, so that's the first thing, to just make sure that you, you know, you remind yourself that you know the revelators are very methodical and precise about their use of language. They didn't just use island because it sounded romantic. Yeah, they wanted to make sure that you understood that this was a literal, standable, honorable object. Okay? All right. Now, even though we've talked about black holes many times, and it's a definitive theoretical object in general relativity. Okay? Now, logically, it's illogical and therefore doesn't exist. But just, you know, set that aside. You know, we don't need to worry about that for the moment. Just think about where scientists are. You use the fact that scientists believe in black holes as a way of measuring how much they don't know. Okay, so notice how they describe this. This is not a small object we're talking about. This can't be just a few solar masses, sort of. This is going to have to be lots and lots of times greater than the mass of our star, our sun, you know, if it's going to be the dominant gravity phenomenon for, you know, thousands of stars, you know, say all throughout a local system or a major part of a constellation or something.
Yeah,
okay. Okay. You're talking a very significant mass. Okay. And it's a solid object. Now, in the current limits of what passes for physical theory today, you know, it you have a little bit of room where they try to rationalize more objective objects that they believe in. They have some ideas about what a nucleus is. Again, they're not true, but they have some ideas about what a nucleus is. And these ideas lead them to think that you could have a lot of mass still stand as a solid object and not collapse into a zero-volume black hole. You know, that it could resist the crushing of all this this gravity by relying on the same thing that they think holds a nucleus together. Okay, and you know, they have this idea that you could actually produce a big ball of neutrons, and they call them a neutron star. Now, again, this is. You have to set aside the immediate question that you should have as the little kid, you know, watching the king go by with no clothes on. It's like, but I thought neutrons only lasted for 20 minutes and then they decay. You know, it's like, well, they have a whole rationalization scheme about that for the nucleus. And so you have that same rationalization scheme going. They imagine this great big ball of neutrons, a neutron star. So they think that there is a solid object that you can make that's really hyper-dense, but they can only imagine them being at about, you know, no bigger than about 3 solar masses. Okay, and then the crushing force of all the gravity would be too much for this so-called strong force of the nucleus. It would break that, and then nothing could stop it, and it would crush down to zero. Okay, well, you know, we obviously are dealing with something bigger than 3 solar masses here. Okay. It's like, well, there is some additional rationalization schemes they try. They'd like to make literal objects. And they have this quark notion, for instance, that they've dreamt up, you know, to further rationalize the nucleus. You know, and so some speculate, well, maybe you could create a quark star. You could create a star, you know, a big sphere that's nothing but a ball of quarks. Well, again, you know, there are no such things as quarks, but let's just imagine there are. And of course, they don't really... There's no way they can really calculate how big they think they could make a quark star before it would, you know, get crushed too. Let's give them the benefit of the doubt. Let's say they could get another factor of 10. So they could get something that maybe was 30 solar masses. I mean, super generous. I don't think anyone would actually assume that right now, but let's just, you know, let's run wild with the idea. We're going to have a 30 solar mass object that uses some magical particle like quarks or some other thing that they might dream up that would keep it solid. Okay, still, I mean, even I give them a factor of 10 over 3, it's still just 30 solar masses. I need something that's going to hold sway over a vast region of space and thousands of stars. Okay, see, that's, you know, there are such objects, very, very, very huge objects in terms of their mass that are solid. They resist all that crushing power. They don't magically get crushed out of existence.
Do they reflect light?
No, I mean, they're going to, by and large, they're just going to be completely, you know, there's such a huge gravitational field that it's just going to capture everything. You know, remember, even our star has enough mass to bend the path of a photon going past. Okay, imagine something this massive, right? It's going to grab right a hold of those photons.
Their description of how they find them wasn't about reflection or anything.
Right, you can't. There's no way to see them. You know, they're not giving off anything because they're stone cold and they're not going to be reflecting anything. So they, you know, you can find them gravitationally. You know, they can look at a vast region of the galaxy and they can see that they're, you know, well, in order for those stars to be behaving like that, to have that dynamics, you got to have this much invisible mass at the center of that collection of stars. Okay, like there's a dark island of space at the very, you know, center of gravity of our local system. The center of Satania, you know, gravitationally is one of these dark islands of space. The supreme power center for our local system resides on that dark island. He does have the fortitude to stand on such a thing. Okay, but you know, so it basically helps to regulate the, you know, the whole system of Satania. Okay, so I just wanted to go through that a little bit to, you know, you'd appreciate you. I mean, how big this is, I mean, I can't tell you, but it's obviously a lot bigger than three. Okay, a lot bigger than three, even a lot bigger than, give them a power, you know, another factor of 10. It's a lot bigger than 30. It's really big. So I mean, that there's that much about fundamental physics that's not known. You know, that many orders of magnitude of ignorance. Okay, to go from what we've figured out in the last 100 years, in which everyone thinks is now all that can ever be known, you know, but really it's just what we figured out in the last 100 years, you know, and I'm being kind of generous with that 100, you know, compared to what could exist in eternity. Okay, so so keep that in mind, you know, that the dark islands are just a great example of how much we have to learn yet. We have to learn enough physics that you can understand how such a huge object can be. We're not even remotely close to such an understanding.
In that previous paragraph that you quoted earlier, it says that these are in composition very similar to Urantia.
Right, it's just matter.
Have you heard about that before?
Yeah, it's just matter. But of course, all matter is automatons, you know, and you start crushing this thing, and you're going to crush all the fluffiness of these automatonic constructs. And it's going to, you know, especially deep down in this core of this object, it's just going to be like a giant automatonic crystal. You know, there's going to be no breathing room to be something fancier than just a pile of caged automatons, okay?
Have anything added to them?
Nothing
but the basic.
And I mean, maybe just as long as that came up, you know. So you imagine if you break these things, if something shattered one of these, you know, automatons are then going to just be flying everywhere. They'll allude to that in a little bit.
Now, are these dark spheres? Is that what science considers to be the black holes?
There's two things about scientists invoking black holes. One is just purely theoretical, that they think that they have valid physical theories that predict that there could be such objects, magical objects. And then when they start looking around in the universe, they see a whole bunch of things they can't explain. So anything they can't explain, they say, well, there must be a black hole doing all that stuff that I can't explain any other way. So every time they say, we've discovered a black hole, what they've discovered is something that they can't explain without magic. Okay, so they use the magical black hole object to explain it.
So it's a theoretical.
Yeah, it's just an association, see, of a theoretical object that can answer any question because it's magical, and a mystery that you've observed. So you say, well, the mystery must be explained by the magical object. Okay, why is it so magical in this sense? You know, it's a literal infinite notion in finite space. So how much do you want it to do? You got a really big mystery, you need it to do lots of things. It's an infinite well of potential. You can make it do anything you want because it's potentially infinite in its manifestation. Okay, because it's a magical object.
Pretty handy.
It's very handy to solve mysteries. You know, and initially they were just solving stellar-sized mysteries with it. You know, now they're solving galactic-sized mysteries with it. Supermassive black holes, okay? I mean, it's a simple gauge. The bigger the black hole that they tell you they've found, the more what they've actually found is physics that goes beyond what we currently know. And the black hole fills in the gap between what's actually there and what we know, which we've absolutized. We think we know everything, okay? And you just fill in the gap between fact and fiction with a black hole.
Nope. If I get you right, their explanation is irrational.
No, their explanation is rational. It's perfectly rational. They have all kinds of equations and everything that depict its rationality. The problem is it's illogical. The initial assumption that you can use this object in a rational, mathematical way is false. I mean, it's a magical object. You're not allowed to use a magical object to explain things. That's just a fundamental assumption, supposedly, of science.
Well, what I got was You put two to two together, that doesn't always make sense, right, with these scientists. That's what I interpret.
They're not constraining themselves with logic. They're just constraining themselves with mathematics, with rationalization. They're not going to allow something to be believed if you can't derive it mathematically. Okay? Now, there's a curious game that they play where they only allow certain magical initial assumptions. You know, you can't just publish any initial magical assumption to rationalize something. There's only certain ones that are accepted as not magical, quote unquote, you know, but valid science, you know, and that's unfortunately an ever-growing set of things because you start with, it's like, you know, it started very, very simply. It's like, well, we'll just allow this one little bit of magic. Okay, because we got this thing we need to explain, and we can't explain it any other way. It's okay, so it's not too bad, it's just one little thing. But of course, they keep looking. You know, if they stopped looking, it would be, but they keep looking, and they keep making discoveries that they can't explain, and so they have to add another little bit of magic. And they keep looking, and they finally find something that you can't explain even with three bits of magic, and so they make it four and five, you know, and it just keeps building and building. Every time they discover something they've never seen before, it is not explainable by current theory. You have to add something to theory in order to explain it. And they put out a press release and say, we've made a great new scientific discovery. We've found this whole new force or, you know, effect or something, you know. Well, all they've found is that they had to add another term to some equation to get it to match the observation. And so now they've discovered a new effect or a new, you know, whatever you would call this new term that they have to add in order to get the theory to match the observation. They never question the fundamental validity of the theory. Okay, they just keep adding to it to make it match. You know, and so they can always say, but my theory agrees exactly with observations. Of course my theory is correct. It's like, well, why does it agree with observations? Because you've modified it until it agreed. Okay?
You closed it until it happened.
Okay. And, you know, that was not allowed before. But, you know, that's accepted practice now. No one frowns on that.
What's the turning point?
Well, I mean, eventually it will just get so insanely complicated. That
from the illogical to the illogical rationing.
Oh, the thing that put them over the edge and allowing magic in is impatience. Fundamentally, the first time they found something really significantly odd, it was in the wake of having decided in the 19th century that the last major theoretical piece had been put together, and that everything could be explained with you know the basic Maxwellian electricity and magnetism, thermodynamics and classical Newtonian mechanics. That those three great theories could explain everything. The first time they found something that couldn't be explained by those three theories, they had gone public long before that. You know that everyone, the common man knew that scientists had dotted the last I. And so here they were. It's like, oh my gosh. And they quietly tried to figure out some rationalization scheme using what they already had, and they couldn't, and they sort of couldn't hide this forever, and so they were getting desperate. They were impatient too. They weren't allowing themselves to be scientists and just letting it be until you could come up with some logical foundation to explain it. They just quickly accepted the first magical explanation that came along and then told the public, we've made this incredible new discovery. So if they had just been patient and stepped back and reflected, if they weren't so frenetic, but remember, there's that materialistic panic in the modern age. They talk about up there in the materialism sections. Towards the end of the book, they were in a panic, and so,
heavy breathing.
Yep. So they compromised their basic scientific principles for the sake of being able to say that. Don't worry, people. We definitely haven't found anything that would question the fundamental materialistic assumption. We're not going to have to invoke God or anything like anything, any transfinite thing or anything like that. All we have to do is just believe that matter is magical, finite matter is magical, and everything is still fine. So,
what were the three big tenets that they were resting on?
Right. Well, the big three that they've broken are the law of causality. That effects have to be the result of causes, because you can't just have causeless effects.
Except for the Big Bang, they allowed that.
Right, so they stopped forcing causality on their theories. They stopped forcing locality. The simple logical law of locality that an object can't be in two places at the same time, or that two objects can't be in the same place at the same time. I mean, you can't have two cups here. There's only room for one cup there. And this cup is just there. It's not here and on the moon. Okay? But they don't, but they let go of that. Now a single object can be in an infinite number of places at the same time. And then the law of identity, that a given object could be two things at the same time. This is both a cup and a banana. That's okay. It doesn't have to be a cup or a banana. It can be both.
Got it.
Okay.
Very handy when you're stuck in the finite.
And so, see, obviously, if you allow violations of causality, identity, and locality, I mean, you got some powerful mojo now in your theories, okay? You can rationalize a lot of things if you let go of those three logical principles. Okay. So, but anyway, don't want to go too far astray on that whole thing. But the way to really begin to right this ship, because obviously if you want to believe in black holes, you're going to believe in black holes. Okay. But if you've been reading this book and you've come to recognize that it has an unexpected integrity to it. You're not just going to dismiss what they say flippantly. You know, and you're going to notice details. You're going to notice that they said island and they said enormous. In other words, they said that there is physics that allows things a lot bigger than three solar masses to be a solid object. You know, and if you just all run with that, what you'll discover is you don't have to reject the negative. Remember how Jesus taught us to approach things? You know, if someone's got some silly notions in their head, forget about that. Try to foster the positive things in them. That they will recognize the value of those positive things. They'll hold on to them more and more, and eventually there just won't be room for those foolish thoughts in their head anymore. When you actually start developing real physics, and you discover that pursuing this real physics, you can explain everything that you've observed, and you never need to use a black hole to explain anything anymore, they'll just fall out of vogue. There will be, it's like, well, okay, it's a fun mathematical object, but I can't find any use for them. Because I've got something logical for everything I've observed.
Yeah. But isn't it necessary in order to come to that conclusion that you have to take on the concept that there maybe is a first source and center, a God of some sort?
Well, in order to get to the point where you accept that this is a revelation.
I'm talking about science. How can they ever get anywhere until such time as they can...
They can't get anywhere until they can accept... Well, that's easy. They need a lot more than that. They need to get to the point where they can accept that this is a revelation. Because the answers to the questions that we have cannot be discovered in any way. We cannot form a logical cosmos on our own. They tell you that point blank. The only way that you're going to be able to construct a logical cosmos is through revelation. This is it. Scientists believed in God, you know, to a large degree for most of scientific history, okay? Just believing in God is not enough. You have to actually have some things revealed to you that are directly involved in science.
But as we're finding out, with so many readers of the Urantia book, many years don't really understand it and are questioning a lot, especially of science. They're constantly trying to compare this to this new scientific.
Right. So you need to be able to step back. You need to be able to objectively assess the quality of this book. Objectively assess the quality of the scientists and compare and contrast. Okay? Is there a difference? If they seem very similar, okay, that's going to be problematic. If it's definitive, it's like, well, when I compare the Urantia book to what I read in scientific journals, the scientists win hands down. I mean, they've got equations and, you know, and on and on. I mean, the Urantia book doesn't have a single equation. Right? I mean, it just doesn't stand up in comparison to what the scientists have to offer. So
the readers of the Revelation don't understand what the hell they're doing.
Right, but the point I'm trying to make is most readers of the Urantia book come to that conclusion. They compare the book to the scientists, and they favor the scientists. Because the scientists seem to have more going in the book. Okay? The problem is, see, you have to get yourself up. You know, you have to get yourself up to the ability to recognize the book. It doesn't spoon feed its recognition to you. Okay? All it gives you is discovery on a silver platter. Okay? It's just here. You can stumble upon it in a bookstore. Okay? So you discovered it, and it wasn't that hard to do. But recognizing it is very hard to do. And decades of reading it have demonstrated that. Recognizing it is very hard to do. Because you have to overcome all of your preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and long-standing prejudices in order to recognize this. You have to be able to go through everything that you've ever thought and let go.
Why is it so easy for some?
Well, it's easy to believe it, but it's not easy to recognize it. How many people have talked...
I'm talking about trusting. Why is it so easy for some to trust...
They don't. That's what I'm saying.
I'm saying it is.
Because they don't go very deep. The deeper you go, the harder it is for readers to trust. Readers break left and right. When they try to go very deep, they can't sort through it. And they either back off and don't go that deep again, or they move on to something else. You know, they try to penetrate deep enough and compare it to what the anthropologists are saying. And they're going, doesn't look like the book stands up. I think I'm going to go read other things.
I think what Maria was saying is that there are some that innately trust their cosmic intuition.
Yeah.
And realize that this is gobbledygook over here. And this just rings so true. Why is that for some?
That basic sort of just general recognition that is solid for a number of readers, okay, is... can be due to a number of things. I mean, you know, basic things are nature and nurture. Okay, if you have a reasonable, objective genetic nature, it's easier for you to recognize things. It's easier for things to be self-evident. I mean, Adam and Eve come because Sangiks don't have any innate ability for things to be self-evident. They need to be uplifted. You know, to acquire self-evident consciousness so that basic things are just recognized, okay? And then, of course, there's the nurture. I mean, the way you were raised and whatnot, I mean, can get you squirreled off in a little nook of subjectivity where you've just never experienced that objective recognition. So, initially you just have that handful. But like I was saying, I mean, that basic sort of just kind of innate recognizing ability is pretty tenuous. Because there are a number of readers who have that, but then they decided they wanted to try to go deeper, and they couldn't. Their recognition ability broke down. They could no longer recognize the greater quality of the details relative to someone else's details. They recognized the general differential, but they didn't hold on to that securely. They started doubting that. It's like, oh, well, maybe it was just a clever illusion, you know, where, you know, as long as you don't open the whited sepulcher, it looks wonderfully white and perfect. But if you actually try to peer in and dissect the details, oh goodness, it doesn't hold up. Okay? That problem is because you have to have taken delight in cultivating something beyond your initial measure of recognition ability that you're given by grace. You can quickly reach the margins of that God-given ability. That's why it's so sad to record. See, you need to have an expanding domain in which you think, because this book is has great depth, and the more you penetrate, the more you have to go out in order to wrap your mind around it. It quickly gets very demanding. You need huge lateral extent in your recognition, and once you penetrate very deep. Jason first.
I just wanted to say what wasn't being said, I'm sure it was on people's minds, was that it's the case of a new wineskin, and a lot of people don't know that this revelation is a new wineskin, and so they just put it back to the other wineskin that they've been serving for so long.
Right, that's the basic thing that we're talking about is to recognize the newness of it, that it's not just a little bit new. It's holistically new. It's an epical revelation. It's challenging you to change everything, not just some little thing, a little part of the picture. Have a little bit better notion about God the Father, say. It's going to give you that better notion of God the Father, which is contingent upon, if you're going to have a logical structure, changing everything else. When you add that, and every other point's like that too. You want a little bit better history? You got to change everything, including your notion of God the Father, and it's all linked together in a holistic challenge. Did you have something, John?
Well, I was just thinking for the scientists, the ones that would tend to look at the revelation and consider it in the mix might be those who have maintained they haven't ignored God or they haven't denied Him.
Right. I mean, obviously you're not going to get anywhere if you don't have some initial embryonic relationship with God. But, the reality is to really get into the fullness of the revelation, you need a lot more than that. You can't be immutably wedded to anything. Your political views, or anything. If you are, the revelation is not open to you. Only little parts. And you'll quickly condense into those handful of paragraphs that you love to read over and over again. Okay? If you want to access the full thing, you can't be bonded to some ism. Okay? And, I stress this. That's the whole point. I'm just trying to point out to people that there's nothing wrong with an initial relationship with the revelation. But are you curious about whether or not there's more there? If you are, then take a deep breath, because you need to challenge yourself to let go. But you'll be rewarded tenfold. Every little thing that you cherish, that you let go of, the revelation will reward you tenfold. Something so much more cherishable, okay? If you can discover that the difference between what it feels to have a relationship with spiritual unity, which is you can definitely cherish, it can be very valuable. But if you can discover what it feels like to have a relationship with triunity instead of merely unity, if you can discover the difference between cosmic consciousness and merely spiritual consciousness, no one will have to ask you to let go of merely spiritual consciousness. The difference is so profound, so easy to distinguish. You will delight in being able to take hold of a triunity relationship with the cosmos and think, wow, I was actually getting by with nothing but a spiritual consciousness before. I thought I was totally satisfied. Wow, how little I knew. How much more fulfilling it is to have a full cosmic relationship to the cosmos. Okay? It's that kind of thing. I mean, it's just like I was saying, I mean, about letting go of black holes. You know, it's the same thing, letting go with, you know, the initial way you think about family or government or anything, economics or whatever it is. If you'll give the revelation a chance, it will reward you. You will, if you actually get a hold of the revelation, you'll never regret letting go of your economic ism that you used to cherish so much. It's that good.
If there are these massive mm-hmm. gravitational dark bodies around the Isle of Paradise, how do we get through there to paradise as ascending pilgrims?
It's why you need a very skilled angel to carry you through there. You're not going to get.
How do they do it?
They're very practiced, and you notice that it's not a transport seraphim that takes you through there. It's a transport seconophim, you know, a higher angel. Transport seraphim doesn't have what it takes to navigate through the dark gravity bodies, and the dark gravity bodies are even more tremendous of a phenomenon than dark islands of space. The dark gravity bodies are really serious business. Okay.
You've got to know where the tunnels are.
Yeah, you've got to. Yeah, I mean there's gaps. You know, it isn't a solid wall, so you have to try to somehow penetrate the wall of it. But you've got to navigate the very turbulent waters, as it were. You know, through the dark gravity bodies. Yeah, and it takes a skilled pilot, a skilled angel to do it.
Yeah. Nobody enters there that shouldn't be there.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Isn't a finaliter?
Right. Once you've got a finaliter, then you can do it.
Right. You get to do it all by yourself.
But that's a serious uphill climb to be able to do that yourself again, you know.
So when you're a finaliter, you fly through it?
Yeah. Well, when you're a finaliter, you'll know how to navigate through there yourself. Yeah.
Do you think it will be like flying?
It's like going from point A to point B, you know. It's not going to be like wings on air. It's not going to be that kind of flying. But it's going to be, you know, translating yourself through space by engaging the energy lanes of the cosmos and riding them. Okay, so that's the biggie in here, the dark islands of space, and just picking that through. Let's get through the other parts here.
Minor space bodies, the meteors and other small particles of matter circulating and evolving in space, constitute an enormous aggregate of energy and material substance. Many comets are unestablished wild offspring of the solar mother wheels, which are being gradually brought under control of the central governing sun. Comets also have numerous other origins. A comet's tail points away from the attracting body or sun because of the electrical reaction of its highly expanded gases and because of the actual pressure of light and other energies emanating from the sun. This phenomena constitutes one of the positive proofs of the reality of light and its associated energies. It demonstrates that light has weight. Light is a real substance, not simply waves of hypothetical ether.
Okay. Now, you know, I mean, you can probably feel a little bit of the arguments from decades ago, you know, towards the beginning of the 20th century in play there. But it's not like they're totally clear on all this yet, actually. So it's important for them to be stressing this here, even today. But let's start with... okay, so you have, you know, the first thing they're saying is basically comets, by and large, are various kinds of debris, okay? And the whole bit about the tail, okay? Notice they bring in two things there. because of the electrical reaction of its highly expanded gases. Okay, so the first thing in play is the solar wind. And I think you guys are probably, by and large, are aware, you know, that the sun puts off a lot of matter. And basically, in this regard, electrons and protons are streaming away from the sun. You know, these charged particles are streaming away from the sun in mass quantities in every direction. Okay, and so that impacts the comet, and there's part of what goes on is related to that. The ionized atoms in the comet's atmosphere, sort of this quasi-atmosphere that it has, interacting with the solar wind. So that's what they're referring to there about the electrical thing, that you have charged particles, ions, you have an electrical interaction with the solar wind. And then the main thing you see that they emphasize is the actual pressure of light. You know, and we've gotten pretty used to that now. You know, we've heard of future thinkers talking about, you know, building solar sails and, you know, using the light pressure from the sun to sail spacecraft around the solar system and things like that, using that pressure of sunlight. And notice the way they talk about this. Okay, one thing is, this phenomenon constitutes one of the positive proofs of the reality of light and its associated energy. So there's a little subtext that they throw in there. We even know that there are massless particles besides a photon, okay, like a neutrino. Okay. Neutrinos and photons, neither of them have mass. Again, I'm challenging the current orthodoxy. They've now rationalized that neutrinos have mass, but set that aside. Okay, neutrinos and photons don't have mass, so they don't have weight, like they're saying here, in the simple sense of, okay, this cup has mass, you know, and gravity gives it a weight in my hand as it pulls down on it in my hand. Okay, they don't have mass, but they do have momentum. Okay, we discovered, you know, that these massless particles pack a punch. When they hit things, what they hit feels it. Okay, they have momentum, even though they don't have mass. Okay, and what they're pointing out here is to see that in a very basic, objective way, that means that it's a little thing. It's not some sort of a deformation in some continuum or whatever. It's a little nugget in some way. It's individuated. Okay, this the word weight, sort of just the basic word weight, implies bear, you know, like, and so a weight bears down on you, you know, when we think about a weight here in the gravity, okay? But if a photon has momentum, it will bear upon what it hits, okay? Okay? It's just pointing out that you have energy that's bottled up, that's wrapped back on itself in some way, that you have this little particle, this individuation, this localization of energy. And because it's localized like that, things have to deal with it if they come into, you know, come up against it. You can't somehow, maybe what would be a good analogy? I mean, if I just visualize a wave, okay, I could imagine being so small relative to this big wave that I don't even really know it's there. I could think about sizes. You know, like if I have a gigantic wave out on the ocean that has such a huge wavelength, that's so much bigger than me that I can't even notice it, I'll think I'm on a calm sea. You know, and this wave could go under me and I'll never even notice it because it's so gradual. It has such a long wavelength. Okay, but if something is really individuated, if it's really localized, it doesn't really matter if it's big or small. It doesn't matter if it's a rowboat or a or an oil tanker, if I'm out on the ocean, I come up against it. I you know, it's just there. Okay? It's not diffused over some region. Okay? And they're trying to give, they're trying to use the word weight in a more generalized sense of that, that it bears upon things, that it has, and it has a, it doesn't have some sort of a generalized response to gravity. It has a very precise, you know, this thing is right here. It has this very precise gravitational reaction. Okay. The whirl and the force charge is kind of fuzzy. But an ultimaton is a hard little spot. It has this very precise gravitational character. It has weight. That's the way they're using the word weight. And they're pointing out that it's not just, you know, that, but we basically understand now only in just a mathematical sense, not in a very objective sense, that the reason that these massless particles have quote-unquote weight still is because their actual wrapped back upon themselves localized individuations of energy. They're not some open energy phenomenon that's just passing through. It's just there. Okay? All right, so light is real substance. It's an actual particle. You know, what do we call that particle? A photon. But the reason I'm stressing this is, yeah, we have this word photon. We have this notion that light is a particle, but not very objectively. A scientist can't tell you objectively what a photon particle is. It's just a mathematical object to him. He can't tell you what that particle is made of. Matter of fact, he doesn't really anymore. He doesn't think so. He thinks that's a simplistic way to think about it. As he said, you know, what it really is both a particle and a wave at the same time.
Sounds magical.
Okay. Which just doesn't sound like I can really get my hands on it very well. All right, it's a cup and a banana. All right. But see, they're trying to point out, no, there's a literal particle, and that's all it is a particle. If you observe waves, that's something else. Okay? And it's like, well, I've assumed that this particle is in a vacuum. There isn't anything else except the particle. Well, but you've observed waves, and particles aren't waves. If you observe waves, there must be more than a particle there. No, there isn't. There's only vacuum. Well, no, that's a reductio ad absurdum. You know you've made a false initial assumption. There must be something else there that there could be waves in. The force charge of space has waves in it. That's where the waves are. The particle is the particle. But the two are coupled. The particle pushes on the force charge. The force charge pushes on the particles. Okay, there's a coupling between the waves and the particles, just like there's a relationship between a boat and the wake that it makes when it goes across the water. There's a relationship between the two. But no one thinks that the waves that lap up against the shore are the boat. But we think that the waves in the wake of an electron are the electron. You know? And of course, you know, in order to, why don't we think that the waves that lap up against the shore are the boat? Because that would be illogical. The boat can't be both out in the lake and at the shore at the same time. Ah, we've thrown that out. An electron can be out there and here at the same time. And when the scientists started saying that in order to understand things, you need to fuzz your consciousness, did that help religion? Religion has always struggled with mysticism. This does not help the mystical problem in religion. You know, it basically validated mysticism for religionists. Okay? You know, Because not only are they challenging the physics like we're talking about here, you know they directly are challenging mysticism too. It's the same challenge. Okay? All right. The same reason that there aren't wavicles is the same reason that there isn't all of those mystical fantasies that religionists have dreamt up over the centuries. All right. Okay, so a little bit more here.
The planets. These are the larger aggregations of matter which follow an orbit around a sun or some other space body. They range in size from planetesimals to enormous gaseous, liquid, or solid spheres. The cold worlds, which have been built up by the assemblage of floating space material, when they happen to be in proper relation to a nearby sun, are the more ideal planets to harbor intelligent inhabitants. The dead suns are not, as a rule, suited to life. They are usually too far away from a living, blazing sun, and further, they are altogether too massive. Gravity is tremendous at the surface.
Notice there's another loose end that they're picking up. Remember I mentioned that back when they were talking about cumulative spheres. Many an inhabited world has had such an origin. You know, and in the immediate context, it seemed like they were wanting to imagine that a bunch of stuff, you know, dust and whatnot, collects together into a planet-sized object out in the middle of nowhere, and then they put people on it. No, okay. It needs to get captured by a star, like they're pointing out here, and get into a habitable region, okay, for beings like us. So they're just picking up that loose end. Can someone give me a simple example of a planet in our solar system we know has a lot of liquid to it? Well, there's the liquid rock inside the Earth. Yeah, yeah. See, there's one. How about something a little bit more exotic? You ever heard anyone talk about some fancy kind of liquid somewhere in one of the planets? Yeah, liquid hydrogen. In which planet?
Venus.
Jupiter. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I thought of it as gaseous. But
it's gas and liquid and solid. Okay. I got a solid core. It's got a lot of liquid around that solid core, and then it's got gas around that. Okay, because it's just a matter of, you know, more the pressure, higher the pressure, then you're going to start condensing this stuff.
Yeah. Don't they think Europa has a lot of something?
Well, of course, you know, they think that moon has liquid water underneath its frozen crust. And, yeah, I mean, there's definitely liquid afoot. Liquid rock, liquid water, even liquid hydrogen. Liquid metallic hydrogen at that.
Jupiter would have been a star with a little bit more mass.
Okay, so if that threw anyone off, I just want to make sure everyone had kind of heard that it's not like we don't talk about the notion of liquid relative to planets. Okay. And then, of course, like they're saying, with when you've got a dead sun as a dark island of space, you know, even if it's only a few solar masses, that's still some heavy-duty gravity, you know. Power beings can stand on it, but not mortals. Oh, and, you know, just in that light, remember how they, up there when they were talking about the high density of these things? You know, the subtext there is you want this really massive object that you're going to use to regulate things, but you don't want it, you know, to be the size of a local system. You want it to be, you know, really effective, but not very extensive. Without getting in the way of everything. So the fact that you can pack that much mass into that small a space makes it a really handy little object. Yeah. A lot of oomph, but not a lot of extent. So it, you know, there's room to have other things going on.
In your super universe, Not one cool planet in 40 is habitable by beings of your order. And of course, the superheated suns and the frigid outlying worlds are unfit to harbor higher life. In your solar system, only 3 planets are at present suited to harbor life. Urantia, in size, destiny, and location, is in many respects ideal for human habitation.
Not destiny. Density. But that too, you know.
An understandable
stuff.
We're
already here.
That's a revelation.
Well, I mean, you know, remember in the up in the Inhabited Worlds paper, they talk about this, that you've got Venus, Earth, and Mars that, you know, are reasonably close to the sun, where it's, you know, they could work, potentially work as a world for creatures, you know, not that different from us. You know, what's the main difference that we observe today about those 3 planets? They all 3 have atmospheres, but the atmosphere of the Earth is very different than the atmosphere of Venus and Mars. Venus and Mars are, you know, like 95% or more carbon dioxide atmosphere. Okay, they have just their original evolutionary atmosphere. Nothing's been terraformed there. Okay? In order to get, you know, the nitrogen oxygen atmosphere that we have, you have to terraform a world. They have, you know, the master physical controllers have to come in and, you know, and get it ready. Okay, no one's done anything to Venus and Mars, and you can tell that by their atmospheres. You know, you don't have to wonder if you're going to find life on Venus or Mars. They have their original untouched carbon dioxide atmospheres. No master physical controllers have gone there and terraformed them. Okay, so there's no life there. Okay, it doesn't matter how much water there is or whatever. It's irrelevant. But if they had decided to terraform them, you've got a lot of atmosphere on Venus, so if you'd made one there with that kind of density of atmosphere, that would have been a super breather world. Okay, you just have a little bit of atmosphere on Mars. If they had terraformed that one, you'd have a sub-breather world there. But they decided for various reasons to not use those 2, and they just used the one in the middle. And that's the general way it goes. I mean, if you look at the percentages they tell you up in the Inhabited World paper, I mean, most worlds, you know, percentage-wise, are like ours, in the middle. You know, and there's a few on the tail of the distribution on each side. Some sub-breathers, some super-breathers. Okay. So that's the 3 they're talking about. Notice they started out, not one cool planet in 40 is habitable, but by beings of your order. They're prefacing this whole thing about, yeah, we all know there's that other issue of the non-breathers. But in terms of like us, there's just those 3. And that's exactly, you know, they bring up this exact example and talk about it specifically up there in the atmospheric types. Okay, a little more here.
The laws of physical energy behavior are basically universal, but local influences have much to do with the physical conditions which prevail on individual planets and in local systems. An almost endless variety of creature life and other living manifestations characterizes the countless worlds of space. There are, however, certain points of similarity in a group of worlds associated in a given system, while there is also a universe pattern of intelligent life. There are physical relationships among those planetary systems which belong to the same physical circuit, and which closely follow each other in the endless swing around the circle of universes.
So let's just put together the first part of that paragraph and the second part of the paragraph first of all. You know, they bring up the issue that there's an environmental context in which a planet exists. It's very important. You know, they have all, you know, and they talk about some of the details of that up there in that Inhabited Worlds paper, about all the various external influences that are imposed upon that planet that they have to take into account. You know, and they're just pointing out, obviously, there's not chaos in the Milky Way galaxy. You know, there's some increasing order, it's a reasonable order even now, so that all of the star systems that have inhabited planets in a given region, as they're going around the Milky Way, they're basically experiencing a similar environment. Okay, so that's pretty straightforward, what they're just pointing out there. That because of the galaxy is not chaos, you can have this similarity in a region just because the environment is going to be fairly similar in a region. Okay, but there's still a lot of variation, and we know that again from that paper about how much variation they make every effort to take into account to utilize. The only planets that aren't inhabited are the ones that are uninhabitable, period, for some reason. I mean, they may have a couple things that would make them habitable, but then there's something else that breaks the possibility for them. And what, there's no way we're going to know, like, why, what's fundamentally wrong with Venus or what's fundamentally wrong with Mars. But something obviously is, or they'd be inhabited. They make everything that's possibly inhabitable. That's the only reason anything exists. It has to be inhabited. Now, the things that they bring in here, we brought this up a little bit last time, so I wanted to just, we got to make this a less old point. We'll just bring this out a little bit more. There are, however, certain points of similarity in a group of worlds associated in a given system. They also mention, your local universe. And of course, even the super universe, too. There's a distinctiveness of life in the seven, in each of the seven super universes. But let's just, because we brought up that system one last time. What's the main issue there? Okay. Now, up front, like I just said, they're going to look around a local system, and they're going to make everything that's possibly inhabitable inhabited. So you're going to have some differential. There's going to be a definite spectrum in all kinds of different ways to the kind of life that you have in a local system. But there's only one system headquarters with one group of material sons and daughters. Remember, the material sons and daughters on a system headquarters world start with a single pair, and a material son and a material daughter. And all the material sons and daughters in a local system are their children, that one pair. So there's very definite genetic similarity amongst all the material sons and daughters in a local system because they stem from one pair of parents. Okay? How does this work? How do you interface this very singular material son and daughter fact with what's going to invariably be quite a bit of variation, okay, in the types of creatures? We brought this up a little bit last time. I mean, Maria brought this up. A simple example is when they talk about what's the initial relationship of the life that's evolving to will creatures on a world relative to sea, land, and air. And your first thought is, well, it's all got to be like us, where it very much is a land phenomenon, and they reveal to you, no. I mean, a lot of times on a world, what ends up being the will creatures very definitively starts out with an extended period in the sea. It doesn't really early on leave the sea like it did here and become very long-established land phenomenon before you finally get will creatures. You actually can get the process of will creatures going when it's still essentially a sea-based phenomenon, or even an aerial species, okay, and everything in between. So you have this broad spectrum relative to sea, land, and air of initial will creatures. And of course, don't forget that by and large, you don't have a pre-colored race like we did. Starting right off with the red race first and going through the colors. So you start out with, you know, all over this spectrum of sea, land, air. But as time goes on, as evolution continues, it begins to coalesce. Okay? Remember that we had for our first will creatures almost 1 billion years ago. The biologic evolution of those will creatures finally peaked right before Adam and Eve came. That's why they come. Okay? And what they point out in that book about the inhabited worlds is you may have a lot of diversity, but by the time that biologic evolution reaches its apex, and an Adam and Eve come, it's all coalesced onto a land creature that an Adam and Eve from Gerasim can mate with. That's how you take the singular nature of the Adam and Eves and you match it up with a great initial diversity. Okay, you get the diversity through evolution to coalesce. See, and the life carriers have designed that in. I mean, think about how different their design of that initial single-celled plant has to be on a world. If they want it, by the time it gets to will creatures, you know, it's one thing if it's going to be kind of on a straight line on the land heading right towards Adam and Eve mateable species, okay? But what if it starts way off here in left field, okay? They have to have it designed in, you know, hundreds of millions of years prior, that it will converge during those last stages of evolution, okay? And then there's one other little thing that Don was alluding to there. The Adam and Eve that go to a world are not supposed to be directly mating. Okay? There's one additional little downstep that they're very vague on the details of. But there's a little bit of a discontinuity between what's going to be mated with and the Adam and Eve that come. And that gap is bridged by their offspring drop down a notch from the Adam and Eve parents to match in precisely with. So you have kind of a clutch sort of, see, that's built in to get it to match up precisely. The evolution brings it in close enough that last little measure of differential can be met by what happens when the Adam and Eve have children. Okay. And then it matches up. Yep.
Some of the other systems, do they have different material sons and daughters?
Right. They would be. There's differences in the material sons and daughters from system to system. Yeah, I mean, I was just about to say, there's not going to be massive differences. Remember, they sort of reminded you that there's quite a bit of commonality within a local universe. And there's even commonality between local universes. I mean, because there's some overall commonality of the super universe. Okay, so, and they also point out that it's all electrochemical, okay? You don't have silicon-based life forms, you know, like in Star Trek and things like that, okay? I mean, it's the basic carbon-based electrochemical, you know, type of life form with all kinds of variations that we can't even really imagine. But it's not going to be as bizarre as a lot of science fiction movies depict. There's not going to be that much variability, you know, where you have human-sized insect creatures and, you know, and on the sci-fi goes like that.
Jabba the Hutt?
You know, and you're not going to have Jabba the Hutt or anything like that, okay? But you're going to have basic bipedal Adam and Eve-like creatures. You know, and it may be that a lot of the difference between the Adam and Eves in two different systems is kind of internal, more than external, even. You know, you can only speculate here. They don't give you a lot to go on.
It does make you wonder if there's some racial memory or fairy story that gets told that gives rise to these legends of mermen and mermaids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can kind of argue that either way. You could imagine there was something that was coming out of old Revelation. But there's an awful lot of avenues for rationalizing that, you know, without it. But, you know, there are some things that they address along those lines. It's not just fantasy and imagination that gives us the notion of birds that you can ride. You know, actually were Fandors. You know, so no wonder we have all kinds of notions of dragons and all this sort of stuff. You know, a lot of that is going to have to do with Fandors, not just imagination. But and not that long ago we had Fandors. You know, that's the amazing thing. It's just not that. It's not like 200 million years ago or something. You know.
Have they found skeletons of them?
No, see, they haven't. And I mean, they found big birds, but not nothing that would fit the Fandor category. And that's most likely because Fandors weren't just random creatures that would could. Yeah, I mean, they were very smart. Plus, they were part of the family. Okay, so you know, it's just very unlikely that one would have died in some weird way where it fell into a mud puddle and got preserved or something, you know, like the endless prolifera of other animals that were just here, there, and everywhere, you know, basically an infinite random death generator, you know, so that you're bound to get, you know, fossilized remains. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if there are no fossilized remains because they were just such an incredibly intelligent and such a very closely loved, valued creature.
Shortly lived in evolutionary years.
Oh well, they were around for quite a while. I can't even see.
What was the date? When were they here?
Well, they're here when Adam and Eve were here. When was that? Less than 40,000 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not that long ago. Right. Yeah, they were here. They were here on this side of the, you know, the Ice Age coming to an end. So we're talking recent times. But in the same way, you know, it's not that easy to find human remains either. You know? Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, once you have cultural things, of course, there's all that. But just, you know, it just even pretty primitive humans were smart enough to not just endlessly get themselves in a situation where their remains are going to be fossilized, you know? That'll do it for that. And next we're going to do the architectural spheres, which will be kind of a fun little change of pace for a section. Okay, but I'm sure they'll do more than that next time. So prepare yourself for section 8. It's a little meaty. Okay, it's a little bit on the order of paper 42. Okay, not as heavy duty, but prepare yourself for a little bit of physics conversation there. And then if you're familiar with this paper, it takes a very fascinating turn and really starts to bring in the more mindful, spiritual, personal side of things, and in a, you know, quite a bit of text yet. This is a huge paper, so we have a whole bunch of stuff on more of the structure, hierarchical structure of the personality management, you know, of the mind made and personality managed aspect of the universe of universes is the way they end up this paper. So we have a little bit more plowing through with the physics and not so much astronomy that much anymore, but more physics, and then we'll get into a little bit clearer sailing if you're finding this a little bit thick. Okay. All right. Let's take a moment here.